Trevor Hoffman joins us on Sports Byline, Hall of Fame relief pitcher who played more than 15 of his 18 years in the majors with San Diego, and he was the Major League's first pitcher to reach the 500 and 600 save milestones and was the all-time saves leader from 2006 until 2011. You know, and when I talk to players that are being inducted into the Hall of Fame, no matter what the sport might be, I always like to get their reaction, and it's been funny, Trevor, over the years, they've each had a kind of different reaction to getting that call saying, welcome to the Hall of Fame. What was yours like?
Yeah, I got to tell you, Ron, to have the anticipation that day surrounding around that phone call, when it finally, the 212 number shows up, you know, not just a flood of emotions, but just really a snapshot of your career flashes before your eyes. And it really happened like that for me, almost 2 seconds worth of little league to high school, to college, to pro baseball and the minor leagues, and ultimately into the major leagues. But it's kind of hard to describe that that can happen in a 2 second period when you say, hi, Jack, this is Trevor Hoffman. And then the ultimate words that he pronounced that you've been elected into the Hall of Fame is one that was a unique moment. It was one that I'll cherish forever.
You know, Trevor, I've known a lot of athletes that have gone into various halls of fame, but the one you're unique in the fact that I met your dad a couple of times when he was working as an usher. And so now to see that his son is going into the Hall of Fame, I really smiled broadly when I saw that. Your dad was somebody who was very special and unique, and I can see that the apple didn't fall far from the tree. Tell everybody what your dad did and how he influenced you.
Well, I appreciate the platform, to be honest with you. How long do we have?
Go right ahead.
Yeah, no, you know, I'm very fortunate to come from a man that, well, first and foremost, loved his family. Secondly, loved his country. He was a Marine, fought in World War II, met my mother over in England. And I had the chance this past October to go over to London and get a chance to see the London Palladium where they had met, my father being a singer, my mother being a dancer, and then ultimately to make their way to America. Dad continued to chase his singing career, which took him to California, where he was met one day by my older brother, Greg, asking who that was at the front door. And Dad putting his personal conquests aside and desires to continue to sing, went and applied to the post office and spent 30 years as a postal clerk, and as you mentioned, an usher at Anaheim Stadium, where he was known very kindly as the singing usher at Anaheim Stadium.
Your mother also was something special as well. She was a ballerina. She came an athletic family, and she taught you to take responsibility, saying, bad workmen always blame their tools.
Yeah, we didn't get much sympathy from Mom, that's for sure. And, you know, you mentioned an athletic family. My grandfather played European football in England, and so that athletic bone was passed down to my mom. And as you'd mentioned, being a ballerina, she takes a lot of pride and takes the credit that she should for our athleticism in athletics and baseball in general for myself and my older brother Glenn, and even Greg had a fine young career as an amateur. But she does take a lot of pride in that. We had two special parents that, you know, really molded us in ways that, you know, I don't think a lot of kids get a chance to see kind of behind the curtain to a degree that they were able to show us.
You know what's interesting, Trevor, and that is the fact that your parents had balance and gave you all balance. And I say that because you were under a lot of pressure because of your talented older brother, but it really never came through. I mean, when I think about your parents, they made each of you feel very special, didn't they?
They did, certainly through their support. But, you know, you mentioned a minute ago, you know, poor workmen always blame their tools. And there was many quotes that Mom would give you, just tighten up the bootstraps if things got a little bit rough and, you know, just run with the winners. And, you know, many little antidotes that we were able to grab a hold of and hang on to in times that were good and bad, you know, and things were going really good. They were the first ones to let you know to be stay humble and, you know, success can be fleeting if you kind of get caught up in it. And so, you know, I respected the fact that they were able to pave the way for us in ways as parents can only do.
I assume that you have some sense of satisfaction. You're going into the Baseball Hall of Fame, but nobody offered you a scholarship out of high school. I don't understand that.
Well, you know, there's definitely certain paths that baseball will allow young people to do. You know, you don't have to be super tall in basketball or overly fast and big in football. Where baseball allows the person to grow and mature at their own pace. And, you know, that was one way that I was able to, you know, take solace in. I wasn't as good as my older brother, as you mentioned, coming out of high school being as small as it was. But there are other ways to ultimately have success in this game. And, you know, I take pride in the fact that, you know, my path was a little bit different than the other five gentlemen that will be honored in July. But I think I can honestly be proud of the fact that, you know, I was aware of that fact and didn't want to just shut it down. I wanted to try and get the most out of what my ability had.
A lot of people may not be aware of the fact that you were a shortstop coming out of the University of Arizona, drafted in the 11th round by Cincinnati, but you transitioned then into pitching. What were the circumstances?
Yeah, a little bit was not hitting really well at the plate, not being able to hit the slider. So I said, you know what, let's try and learn how to throw one. the arm strength from shortstop intrigued my manager, Jim Ledd, at the time. And while Barry Larkin had supplanted himself in Cincinnati and wasn't going anywhere, and ultimately led to a Hall of Fame career in his own right. But there were other men in front of me at the higher levels, so I wasn't going to move them anytime soon. And so they said, hey, the kid's got a pretty good arm. Let's see if he can gravitate to the mound and take hold of some things that pitching might offer. And so I think the biggest thing is that I wasn't necessarily disgruntled about that potential career change. I embraced it. I knew the writing was on the wall, and I embraced this opportunity full-heartedly. And I think that allowed me to kind of learn quickly. It allowed me to not put too much pressure on the situation, and ultimately worked out pretty quick.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of pro athletes get kind of stuck in the way they've always done it, but that was not the case with you. The one word I would put to you besides being talented was you were always very adaptable, because the Marlins acquired you in the 92 expansion draft, and then the Florida Marlins traded you to San Diego. And even though you had a powerful fastball, an injury really changed your need to do something else. Tell me about that adaptability in your career.
Yeah, you know, I would have loved to have, you know, and it's by my own design, but I did injure my shoulder, you know what, being a kid and young at heart and messing around with, you know, other sports when I probably shouldn't have. And my velocity decreased. I went from probably comfortably in the mid-90s without a changeup to a kid that was going to, you know, touch the top end at 90 miles an hour. And so, albeit I was able to be successful with that, I did need an equalizer-type pitch. And so I was able to develop a changeup rather quickly that became effective. But more than anything, I didn't lose my location. I didn't lose my ability to command the fastball where I wanted, and everything was kind of set up after that. So instead of, you know, crying over spilt milk and the fact that I'd hurt my shoulder and that some velocity had gone away, there was a way of an opportunity to try and figure out a new way to get people out, and that was to continue to focus on being able to throw the ball where I wanted to and develop a good changeup.
You know, it's interesting. Your dad was very protective of that arm. He didn't really trust the coaches that they would protect your arm, and so he didn't let you pitch after you were 12 years old. I didn't realize that.
Ron, you know what? He could only save us from ourselves so long. But, you know, he was right on. I think he always had an eye for the future, and he didn't really want us playing football either. He felt like it was a pretty vicious sport and one that we potentially could get hurt playing that as well. But he did. He wanted to make sure we didn't get an overzealous coach that saw a good arm and would want to try and win a ton of Little League awards, you know, high school awards and whatnot. He wanted to make sure we had a protected arm and one that if we had to fall back on it, much like I did, that it would be somewhat underused. And so that was the case. I was able to transition to pitching with a fresh arm, not a lot of, you know, clutter in my mind as far as mechanics were concerned. And so ultimately it was a quick transition. It was not overcomplicated. I kept things simple on the mound, just tried to throw strikes. Obviously I had the velocity, and then, like I said, had the figure out a way to overcome my own mishaps and make things work.
Your dad was a man ahead of his time when it came to football, I
no
think.
No doubt.
Trevor Hoffman is with us, Hall of Fame relief pitcher, who played more than 15 of his 18 years in the majors with the San Diego Padres. We'll talk more about his outstanding career as we continue across the country and around the world on Sports Byline. Trevor Hoffman has joined us on Sports Byline. We're talking about his outstanding 18-year career, 15 of those plus with the San Diego Padres, and he was the Major League's first pitcher to reach the 500 and 600 save milestones and was the all-time saves leader from 2006 until 2011, and as I said, Hall of Fame relief pitcher. Now, tell me a little bit about the mindset of being a starter as compared to being the mindset of a closer or even a relief pitcher.
You know, I kind of wonder the same thing. I didn't have too long of a stint as a starter, and when I did, I kind of had that mentality of, you know, one pitch at a time, complete focus, and give 100%. And it wasn't until I had a teammate by the name of Kevin Brown who talked a little bit about how he attacks his starts, and he basically said, "I'm like Hoffy. I go out there for an inning at a time, a pitch at a time, and I give it max effort, and I try and go nine innings in a game." And so he was like a microcosm of a closer as a starter. And so that's kind of all I ever knew. Obviously, there's different ways that you have to prepare your body. You are once every 5 days as a starter, and as a reliever, you have to be ready to go on a daily basis. And so, in essence, I think both were easy, in a sense, to prepare for, because as a starter, you knew exactly what days you needed to get your running in and what days you needed to get your bullpens in. And as a reliever, you just based it off of what you did the night before on what you would ultimately do the next night and then what it would turn into the next night. So I think it was just being astute. It was about paying attention to what your body needed and what it was telling you. I was fortunate to have great people around me. Todd Hutchinson was a trainer that worked with me most of my career in San Diego and kept me on the field as long as he could. Couldn't have been more pleased with the effort that we were able to do together. And I'm just lucky in general to get that stuff kind of done.
Yeah, and I think the adaptability, the word that I used a little bit earlier, probably came into play. Because if you think of starters, they're saying, okay, I'm going to be pitching on this day, every 5 day games. But when you're a reliever, you really have to clear your mind of all of that, do you not? And say, hey, when the phone rings out in the outfield, I'm ready to go.
No doubt. And in all honesty, that things could be going your way in the seventh inning. It's looked like you're going to go in and it doesn't happen until your team scores five or the other team scores five and it doesn't happen. I think what you learn quickly as a reliever is you don't take anything for granted. You prepare like you're going to go into the very last second. And if it doesn't happen, you make your assessment of what transpired that day, and then you make a determination of how you want to move forward. And so there are great things about being a starter in that everything is pretty geared to when you know you're going to get the ball in your hand. And I think it just fit my personality a little bit better, being able to say, you know, as a reliever, I was comfortable on what was going to transpire each and every day.
And Trevor, there's another aspect. Correct me if you think I'm wrong about this, but usually when relievers come in, particularly on closers, it could be in an inning which there's one or two guys or the bases loaded. So you're throwing not from, the full stretch. You're throwing from the side to some degree. Is that an adaptable thing as well? Do you have to forget about how you're throwing the ball to the plate?
To a degree, you do, no doubt. I think you take into account the game situation. You can't just lay a cookie in there with a three-run lead and nobody on. If you have come in with guys on base, you're coming into the heat of a game-changing type of situation. And so you need to make sure you walk into the game with your best stuff and you're able to execute immediately. You don't have time to really get a feel of the game. And so that part of it as a reliever was fun. It was exciting to be able to know that most of the time when you came into a game, you were going to be walking a tightrope and the game was going to be on the line. But as a starter, you never know what pitch is going to be the determining factor. You might have given up a homer in the second inning, and it's only a 1-0 ball game, and that might stand up. And you look back and go, if I'd only pitched differently in that one situation, maybe it would have come out different. So I think the mentality of just keeping things very simple, trying to stay in the moment, be able to execute the one thing that you can control at that moment, and that's that particular pitch, and then you do it again the next pitch, and you do it again the next pitch, or ways that you kind of stay sharp.
I think the pitcher is the only one that truly appreciates the catcher, and I think that relationship between pitcher and catcher is so special. And Bruce Bochy once said, Hoffman's one of those guys like Tony Gwynn. They never feel like they've arrived. They just keep working and make sure that they've got goals they want to reach.
Well, I was pretty lucky to play for what's going to be a Hall of Fame manager in Bruce Bochy. And he certainly had a way about him of being able to read people, being able to read the situation. But he hits the nail on the head with that. Being able to watch Mr. Padre and Tony Gwynn go about his business for 8 years as a teammate and not take anything for granted, even though he could have as a tremendous hitter that he was, and a surefire first ballot Hall of Famer, even though he kind of wouldn't let him think that far down the road. It was pretty special to be around those two type of people that were so impactful in the game and understand my place. Being able to be around him was pretty awesome.
And you staying even keeled, I think, is really part of, if not a major part of, the credit that you played 18 years, because there was the quote, after every save, whether he converted it or blew it, Hoffman would sit in the dugout for 5 minutes after his teammates had cleared out, whether it was the euphoria from success or the sting of failure, he would sit there and drain all the emotion out of himself, put the game behind him, and move on. You could do that quickly and that easily?
Well, I tried to. I think more than anything, it was a debrief. It was trying to figure out what worked that particular day, what didn't work out that way, and, you know, what could I learn from that situation and maybe moving forward the next time I'm in that same situation. So it was just the ability to reflect on what just happened. You do come into a very heightened situation and the crowd's lively, and then good, better, and different. It's a very different setting, you know, whether you've had success or failure, sitting in that dugout 5-10 minutes after the game. And so it was a great opportunity to kind of just reflect on what just happened before I walked into the clubhouse and had to answer questions, good or bad. It just allowed me to kind of process what just happened.
I remember talking to Dennis Eckersley, and I said, what's the greatest asset that a closer can have? And he said, a short memory.
That's great. Well, you know, Eck was one of the best, and not just because he executed, but I think it was personality. I think the game appreciated the personality that he had and the fun that he had while he played the game, and didn't take himself too serious. But there is some truth to having short memory in this role. And, you know, there's nothing you can do to control what's going to happen next based off of what happened in the past. And so you might need to learn that ability to have short memory.
We only have a couple minutes left, but when you think of all the great pitchers, whether they be starters or whether they be relievers, what's the commonality they all have, Trevor?
You know, consistency kind of jumps off the page at me. Something that they all know what they're good at. They understand, you know, their strengths. And so being able to be consistent with their strengths, whether it's, you know, the Greg Maddoxes and the Pedro Martinez of my era, you know, and seeing teammates like Kevin Brown, I mentioned earlier, and Andy Ashby. These guys knew what they did very well. And, you know, it was a pleasure to watch them compete and understand what they had going well for them on a particular day. But to have that bulldog mentality, have that predator approach, I thought was something that they were able to show on a daily basis.
One of the things that concerns me a little bit is people fall in love with the jugs gun, giving the speed of a pitch. And yet the guys that you just talked about, a lot of them knew where they wanted to spot the pitch. And that, to me, is something that's more important than speed, because they're – You mentioned Greg Maddux. I mean, here's a guy that didn't throw 95 or 100 miles an hour, but he had a Hall of Fame career as well.
No doubt. And I think that is something that, you know, you can't really teach velocity. And so I feel like teams really want to be able to, hey, have that in their, you know, in their arsenal. They'll bring those guys on in hopes that, and they feel like they're headstrong in the fact that we can teach these guys command and mechanics and control. And sometimes it doesn't happen. And you sit there and you scratch your head and you're like, oh my gosh, this guy has a $1 million arm. He can throw it 95 miles an hour, just flicking it up there, but he can't find the plate. And so there's a balance there. You know, it's obviously much more difficult to get hitters out when you're throwing 85 miles an hour and you can still dot it up a gnat, if you will. But to be able to blend the two of them, I think was special. But I think if the art of pitching is the ability to not worry about the radar gun, it's reading swings, it's reading how they took a swing against your fastball versus your changeup, and ultimately making a decision on what the next pitch should be.
We only have a minute left, but how did the AC/DC's Hell's Balls come into play?
You know what? It was kind of a little bit of an afterthought. We kind of introduced it in 98, in the middle of that season's run, and having already gone out there to multiple different songs, we'll say, Chip Bowers came down from the entertainment department and said, hey, you know, why don't you try this? It's got kind of a cool introduction with the bells and the lead guitar, and then it goes into some music that I think the fans would like. And I'll tell you, Ron, I had no idea it would turn into as big of a show as it did. It became larger than life, became bigger than the event that people were watching. I think people just stuck around just so they could see the entrance, and then they get a head start on maybe getting out of the parking lot on time. But it was one that I knew I could always rely on that energy to go out there and try and get things done.
Trevor, I want to thank you for your time. Every time we've talked, it's always been insightful to me, and I'm sure it's been insightful to fans and also the people that hear it. Thank you and congratulations. You deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, not only for your ability, but for the person that you were off the field as well. I thank you, my friend.
Ron, I really appreciate it, and I do enjoy my time speaking with you, and it's always fun to walk down memory lane. I appreciate it.
Take care. Trevor Hoffman with us, Hall of Fame relief pitcher who played for more than 15 of his 18 years in the major leagues, playing with the San Diego Padres, and he also was the major league's first pitcher to reach 500 and 600 save milestones and was the all-time saves leader from 2006 until 2011, and now he can also say he's in the Hall of Fame. We continue across the country and around the world. We've got you on Sports Byline.